On the other hand, my research suggests that there is a certain structure. When you look at the pattern of what Al-Qaeda is doing, as described conventionally, you say a group is Al-Qaeda, this is a group defined as Al-Qaeda, it's doing this, this, this. When you look at it, there seems to be a pattern there. I'll talk about that pattern in a minute. The first thing I want to mention here is who actually invented the word Al-Qaeda. And actually, Robin Cook, the late Robin Cook, has something to say about this. He wrote an article in The Guardian one day after the 7th July attacks. And he said, he's the only guy to have actually said this, by the way. He said that the term Al-Qaeda was invented by the CIA and referred literally to a database contained in a computer file, listing, quote, Robin Cook says, the thousands of Mujahideen who were recruited and trained with help from the CIA to defeat the Russians. And this is an extraordinary statement because it says two things. Firstly, it says that an entity referred to as Al-Qaeda did actually exist to some extent. It existed since the Cold War. But the second point it makes clear is that this existence was not necessarily the same as a real-life organisation which actually exists out there in a very concrete sense, but rather its existence is in the form of a database of CIA Mujahideen recruits. And it suggests that this particular group of recruits could be linked to a very specific category of covert military intelligence operations. In that particular context, we're talking about people who were considered useful in Afghanistan to repel Soviet invasion. Now, this is very interesting because the conventional wisdom admits that, yes, you know, we hooked up with Osama bin Laden during the Cold War and we wanted to kick the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan, and that was it. After that, you know, bin Laden became our enemy and he started fighting us, and now we've got the war on terror, and that's really it. And basically, this narrative is just not true. It just doesn't make any sense when you look at the facts. And there's a very, very good book. I wish I had the book. Don't have the book with me. There's a book by a guy called Richard Lebivier. He's currently chief editor at Radio France International, but he's actually Swiss. He's a Swiss television journalist. And the book is called Dollars for Terror. And it's based largely on interviews with European CIA officials. And one of the guys he interviewed was a CIA analyst. And this was after the Cold War, long after the Cold War. And the guy said to him, he was asking him about what was the CIA's policy towards Al-Qaeda. And the guy said, the policy of guiding the evolution of Islam and of helping them against our adversaries, i.e. Soviets, worked marvellously well in Afghanistan against the Red Army. Okay, we know that. The second statement is very important. He says, the same doctrines can still be used to destabilize what remains of Russian power and especially to counter the Chinese influence in Central Asia. Now, this statement is absolutely crucial. It says that there is a continuity, a conscious continuity of policymaking. To not to say, let's forget bin Laden, let's just move away. It says, no, the doctrine of destabilization that we use in Afghanistan can still be used to destabilize what remains of Russian and Chinese power. So let's think about this geographically. Geographically, this has a very obvious implication. Russian and Chinese power means Eastern Europe, the Balkans, Central Asia. Those are the traditional spheres of influence. So if you wanted to test that hypothesis, you would look at those areas and say, okay, let's see. And that's basically what I did. Richard Lebivier didn't do that. And most of my research on 9/11, or the kind of stuff that interests me the most, is looking at Al-Qaeda's role in relation to Western military intelligence in the post-Cold War period. And I've got two bits here. This is my third book called The War on Truth. And that is kind of like I call it my magnus opus on Islamic strategy, because you can see it's quite fat. And I really, the writing's a bit small. And I'm telling you, when I look at this myself, I get bored out of my brain. So, you know, if you're interested in getting kind of the big lowdown, it's good. But this is kind of a bit easier to read. But that covers most of the stuff. And this is, I'm quite proud of this, because this is a paper, it's a peer-reviewed journal. This is very expensive, it's about $70. in the United States, but it's Research in Political Economy. It was published this year. It's contributions from a number of academics about 9/11. It's called The Hidden History of 9/11. It's a brilliant book. It talks about, I mean, I would say it's that because my article's in there as well, but but my article in there, I mean, there's articles in there about all kinds of things, even about the World Trade Center collapse and all kinds of things. But my one in there is about Al-Qaeda. And in I look at a couple of case studies in there, but if you take my work together, I've looked at Al-Qaeda in Azerbaijan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Bosnia, Kosovo, Macedonia, Algeria, Libya, the Philippines, and Chechnya. And that is basically, if you look at that regionally, you're looking at Central Asia, the Middle East, the Balkans, North Africa, the Asia-Pacific, and the Caucasus. So that's really, you're talking about the bulk of the world's major strategic regions. In every major strategic point in the world, Western power is symbiotically conjoined to Al-Qaeda, either financially or militarily or through intelligence connections. And it's not a conspiracy theory. It's absolutely hugely well documented. I don't know what you might think of conspiracy theory, but my interest is in understanding facts and the way they work and interpreting them. And just to give you a kind of one example, because we're running out of time, and I'm conscious of that, but give you one example just to give you an idea of the salience of this kind of research. I mean, let me think. There's a couple of examples I could give. There's one example that might be familiar to you. Is anyone aware of David Shaler?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Are you familiar with his whole story with Libya?
Yes.
Yeah. To some extent. So, how many people are familiar with the Libya story and Al-Qaeda? Mm-hmm. Some of you. Well, it's an example. Just to give a brief lowdown, I think I'll give another example, but some of you are familiar. David Shaler worked for MI5. I don't agree with a lot of what Shaler says, but I think some of his story of what happened in Libya is quite interesting. Basically, the thrust of what he said was that MI6 had a deep undercover operative in an Al-Qaeda cell in Libya. And what they had done, they had paid about £100,000 to this cell to carry out an operation to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi. And the whole thing just went completely wrong. They actually ended up blowing up a civilian car and killing civilians. And the thrust of that, basically from a moral perspective, is simply that in 1996 there had already been the World Trade Center attack. There'd been an attack at the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, for example. They knew that Al-Qaeda was a threat. So from that perspective, what were they doing, applying money to an Al-Qaeda cell to carry out a covert operation, if Al-Qaeda was in fact an enemy? I'm not suggesting that, I'm not quite sure how to, I mean, I think the question of Al-Qaeda's relationship to the establishment is one that needs further research and further clarification. But that to me is a very interesting example of how the official narrative doesn't quite make sense of the actual facts. And it gets worse. I mean, the examples that I've discussed, if you look, for example, at Algeria, where you have a state which is fighting a civil war against a bunch of Islamic terrorists there's the GIA, the Armed Islamic Group, and there's the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat, GSPC. These groups are, I mean, the conventional story is that these groups, after the 1991 elections were cancelled, basically formed as kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with Algeria. In 1991, there are democratic elections which the Islamic Party won, and the military moved in really with tacit support from France, from the United States, from Britain, cancelled the elections. And since then, the whole country was plunged into civil war. And then you had the emergence of these terrorist groups, which are described as Al-Qaeda affiliates. There's supposed to be interpenetration of mujahideen, of weapons, of funds, so on and so forth. The problem is that the Algerian government is saying that it's fighting its war against these terrorists. And they're saying that these terrorists are killing civilians, hundreds and thousands of them. and carrying out terrorist attacks in Algeria. Some of them even, I mean, apparently these terrorists also carried out an attack in France, the 1995 Paris metro bombings. Now, the problem with this story is there's a spate of very interesting reporting here and also in France in 97 and 98. Robert Fisk in The Independent, John Sweeney in The Observer in particular come to mind. But they actually got information from Algerian security service, former Algerian officers from the Algerian security services, who basically said that they had been working as part of a very clandestine operation which had penetrated these apparent Islamic terrorist groups and were actually carrying out terrorist attacks using these groups in order to justify the militarization of state policy and to justify essentially cracking down on political resistance. So this was a very, 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 very different picture. And in fact, this picture has now been corroborated more and more, especially in French. There's not a huge amount of literature in English, but in French, there's a burgeoning literature. In particular, there's a number of books published in France by a number of officers who worked in senior positions in the Algerian intelligence services. There was also a bunch of Foreign Office files that came out. I think it was either 1999 or year 2000. And there was this terrorist case against this guy, and it collapsed because the defence basically brought out all of this. They had asked the judge to get these Foreign Office files released. And when they came, it consisted of MI6, MI5, and even some State Department documents, all of them confirming that basically we've known for years what the Algerians have been doing and haven't done anything about it. But in fact, we've been doing a lot of things about it. We've been plying Algeria with financial aid. We've got very important oil and gas agreement with Algeria. We've been plying them with counter-terrorist assistance. Basically, we are complicit in what Algeria is doing. So I would suggest that the examples of Algeria and Libya, and they proliferate across regions, they give two ways of understanding the way we are relating to Al-Qaeda today. The first is indirectly through a state intermediary, where a state has penetrated a certain network which has some kind of connection to Al-Qaeda, or alleged connection, or described in that way anyway. And we then have a connection to the state, either through financial or military intelligence assistance, or there is a direct connection. The Libya example is a case where we actually had, through our own agents, connections on the ground. This is what happened in Bosnia and Kosovo and Macedonia, where we actually had direct liaisons with Al-Qaeda operatives which we were flying in, for example, into Bosnia. But we won't go into that too much. I think that kind of gives a summary. In the Q&A session, maybe we can elaborate a bit more. But what does this then imply? If this is true, how do we interpret this in terms of understanding what's happening now under the guise of the war on terror? And my take is basically that you cannot any longer look at international terrorism in the form of Al-Qaeda as merely an enemy. On the contrary, Al-Qaeda has two particular roles, it seems to me. One is its existence, however it does exist, it's a questionable issue, legitimizes the wholesale militarization of Western societies and is also subject, when possible, to Western control and manipulation in order to secure very specific strategic and economic interests, you know, in different theatres of operation. So throughout the post-Cold War period, Al-Qaeda has actually functioned as a vehicle of Western covert operations in the service of what I would argue are powerful corporate interests, particularly related to the monopolization of global energy resources. If you look closely at these regions, you find that most of the operations are about accessing regional oil and gas. Just as an example, if you look at Bosnia, Kosovo and Macedonia, and the manner in which, I mean, from 1992 to 1995, the Pentagon flew in about 1,000 Al-Qaeda Mujahideen, and this came to light from the Srebrenica inquiry into the genocide by the Dutch. There's an appendix to that, based entirely on Dutch intelligence files, and a guy called Cees Weebs, who's a professor in Amsterdam, he actually wrote that appendix, and it details very clearly how the Pentagon actually did this quite directly. And it's pretty clear that doing that just destabilized Bosnia beyond all proportion. It actually it provoked a genocide without any doubt. And that kind of policy was replayed in Kosovo. And in 1999, there was an interesting statement made by Sir General Mike Jackson. At that time, he was commander of UN troops. And he said, "We will stay here for a very long time to guard the energy corridors that cross Macedonia." So even if we factor in that, yes, there may have been a humanitarian dimension at some point whatsoever, you cannot discount the crucial role of energy and the fundamental role of energy in motivating this operation. So if you want to make sense of that, using the three-tier approach that we developed with the Cold War, how do we apply that today? Well, it seems to me that Al-Qaeda's trajectory, the way it's functioned today in the post-Cold War period, conforms very much to that same kind of self-reinforcing structure. The first tier is much the same. You have a predominance of Anglo-American interests in the expansion and consolidation of a US-dominated capitalist world system. The second tier is, again, that there is a paucity of clearly identifiable regional threats that are sufficient to legitimise the militarisation required to pursue those interests in those regions. And the third issue then, very similar, is the ideological and operational construction by Western military intelligence services of a projected external threat consisting of Al-Qaeda-directed international terrorism. And this threat is used selectively and systematically, occasionally as a propaganda tool to justify certain policies, and also on the ground as a covert operations tool to destabilize specific regions. I've got a last section there, which was about why. The why of it. Why is this all going on? And I think that's a very important thing. We need to cover that. Because as we approach the turn of the new millennium, it became increasingly clear to policymakers that the global imperial system, as it has been constructed since the Second World War, was being plagued by multiple escalating global crises, which threaten within... I mean, it depends what perspective you come from, but my take is... I'm a cynic, I take a worst-case scenario, that within about 10 to 15 years, these crises are going to fundamentally destabilise the current structures of power. And I actually wrote an article about this, a very short article, a couple of months ago, and I'm going to draw from that. I'm going to repeat some of those things verbatim, so I apologise if you've read that article, you know what I'm going to say. But basically, I interviewed a guy who works with the Arlington Institute in the United States. The Arlington Institute is in Washington, and it was set up by James Woolsey, the former CIA director. And we had a meeting with him for various reasons to discuss cooperation, because they're very conservative, very establishment. And basically, he confirmed, almost to an even worse degree than I personally had feared, that the extent of the crises at this point is actually probably worse than I had imagined. And he talked about three things. He talked about oil, he talked about the economy, and he talked about the environment. And in terms of oil, I mean, I heard two of you discussing peak oil before. I thought, I won't say anything now. I'll bring it up. And basically what he said is that he believes that the latest petroleum data indicates that global oil production probably peaked 2 years ago. And in fact, that was the conclusion I came to independently about a year ago. And so this is what I've written in my book. I actually thought it peaked a couple of years ago. And it's a number of experts concur on that. And I think there's a growing consensus in amongst the oil industry. I'm talking about independent oil industry experts, not talking about just the oil companies. In fact, most of the oil companies are in denial about peak oil. Shell, for example, is busy drilling, looking for oil shale and looking for other types of conventional oil, and completely denying that there's a problem. BP is really doing the same thing. So most of the oil companies are in denial. But just to give you a couple of people who concur, there's one guy, Dr. Colin Campbell. He's one of the preeminent experts on oil depletion. He's got a centre in London. And he said, basically, we've come to the end of the first half of the oil age. And he had predicted in the late 1990s that world oil production would peak early 21st century. There's another guy, Kenneth Dayforus, who's a geologist. He's also a professor at Princeton, a professor emeritus at Princeton. He wrote a book. I don't have the name of the book, but he also pointed out... Sorry?
I wrote
Is, oh, okay. Is that the latest one? Is it, I'm sure he's written...
He might have done another one.
Yeah, I mean... But yeah, he's written a couple of books, I think. But Hubbard's Peak is one. And he pointed out... He believed that the occurrence of the peak occurred near the end of last year. So there's some variation, but there seems to be a concurrence. But for those of you who wonder, what the hell does it mean to peak? I keep talking about peak. What does it mean? Basically, it's simple. There's a physical amount of oil on the planet. And the theory of peaks suggests that basically when half of those global oil reserves are gone, then it becomes increasingly difficult to actually pump the oil out. Geophysically, technologically, it just becomes harder and harder to do it. It doesn't mean that there's no oil. It means that it's more difficult to do. But what that happens is if you look at a graph of it, also there's the peak. And supply will start to slow down just because it's so difficult to get it, and it will get lower and lower and lower. And the problem is that consumption demands are getting higher. So the peak predicts that there's going to be a crisis, because as demand is lowering, consumption is increasing, and at a certain point, it's just not going to meet. It's not going to happen. So there's going to be a point when consumption needs outweigh how much oil is actually coming out. So that's the idea, there's a crisis. And in fact, if you look at the petroleum data, most of the oil-producing countries have already peaked. It's pretty clear. Even the Saudis, for example. The Saudis recently announced that they've got billions of barrels of oil, and they keep insisting they've got so much. But in fact, they've consistently failed to meet their own quotas, and it's actually their production is decreasing over time. The second issue is... that I mentioned is the economy. And the guy I spoke to also said that he's spoken to leading US financial analysts who privately believe that a collapse of the global banking system could be imminent by 2008. And when he told me that, I was kind of like, I was a bit skeptical. I was like, yeah, right. But then I did a bit of research. I know the global economy is very unstable, but I wasn't clear that... How did he know it was going to happen in 2000? Why did he have that date? But there was an analysis by Gabriel Kolko, who's a very well-known historian. He's at York University. And he did a whole article. It was in Counterpunch, the problems in the global economy. And this is what he said. He said, all the factors which make for crashes, he only said this earlier this year in July, excessive leverage, rising interest rates, etc., exist. Contradictions now rack the world's financial system, and a growing consensus now exists between those who endorse the financial system and those who oppose it, who believe that the status quo is both quite crisis-prone as well as immoral. And he says, if we are to believe the institutions and personalities at the forefront of the defence of capitalism, and we should, it may well be that we are on the verge of a serious crisis. And that scared the pants out of me, I'm telling you, when I read that. And finally, there's the third issue. I mean, there's other issues as well, but I've got those three. And the third issue is the environment. Most conventional estimates suggest that global kind of climate catastrophe isn't going to be due before another 30-odd years. But he argued that this was basically too optimistic. He said that the experts that he's in touch with have said that there could be an overlapping of several tipping points. The tipping point is really just a situation where, say you have, I'm not an expert on the environment, but say you have an example of the Arctic regions, and if they melt below a certain level, it becomes irreversible, the effect of that, and it can result in an irreversible chain of climatic events. And that's what a tipping point is. And there's a number of tipping points which apply to different areas of the climate. Okay, let me finish my point. Which was on global warming, which, okay, some people don't believe in that. I think there's a very strong case to be made that the period of global warming we have today is unprecedented. But anyway, what I've got here, I've got a quote from... This guy I spoke to said that he believed, from the people he's spoken to, that if a number of tipping points were triggered simultaneously, that could trigger a series of very devastating climatic events within the next 10 to 15 years. And there's a number of... there was a couple of reports that came out very recently. There was one report, joint report, by the Institute for Public Policy Research here in the UK. They did it jointly with the Centre for American Progress in the US and the Australia Institute. And this came out last year. And they said that if average world temperature rises 2 degrees centigrade above the average world temperature prevailing in 1750 before the Industrial Revolution, then this would almost certainly trigger an irreversible chain of climatic disasters. And then they went on to kind of describe some of the possibilities that could happen. And finally, actually, there was one final point, which was on the war front, was that actually the source also mentioned, this guy mentioned that that US generals had also repeatedly wargamed a prospective conflict with Iran on the request of President Bush. And they had consistently found that the simulations predicted, quote, an absolute nuclear disaster, unquote, from which no clear winner would emerge. And the generals thought the scenarios were so dismal that they strongly advised the administration to avoid such a war at all costs. But this guy said that the Bush administration was ignoring their fears. So that was another kind of potential crisis. So that's my summary of kind of escalating problems facing the world. And I think there is circumstantial evidence that suggests that even if we have doubts about whether some of these things are real or not real, or exaggerated or interpreted, there's no doubt that certain policymakers at very senior levels believe that this is what's happening and are taking drastic measures on that basis. There are reports from Dick Cheney's Energy Task Force about oil depletion. There's a number of other reports that have come out from Dick Cheney in relation to an oil crisis. And some of these weren't originally meant for public consumption. They were meant only for the government. So there's clearly consciousness there. There have been Pentagon reports about the possibilities of climate change and its drastic effect for security policy. So there is certainly a huge amount of planning going on, which is conscious of the fact that the system itself is basically in decline. It's in drastic decline. So what's happening is not happening from this position of supreme power, that you have the Americans sitting there going, we're going to take over everything. It's like, no, there is a very real fear that the system is unravelling in much the same way that the British Empire was unravelling, you know, about a century ago. So now there is this program of how do we maintain this structures of power in the face of this drastic decline? And this comes back to the question that you raised about why is there no real interest in alternative energies? And in fact, there is a lot of evidence that shows that the American government, the British government, are very clued up about the prospects of alternative energies and the viability of alternative energies, but they don't want to have alternative energies. And the reason they don't want alternative energies is because alternative energies imply a very different form of social organisation. If you take solar energy, if you take wind power, if you take even the other ideas, there's new research into different kinds of energy reactors using nuclear fission and all kinds of things. There's also really cutting edge research, even in cold fusion and other kinds of things, and even in there's another area of physics called zero point energy. I know someone looking at you thinking, what are you talking about? You're talking about energy, but zero point energy physics is actually an area of physics which is, it's not many people are working on it, but it's an area that potentially holds a lot of answers. There's a wealth of research, and many, many energy experts have written studies about the viability of alternative energies. And what they imply is that really, in that state of
mind... Al Gore wrote a book about the viability of electric cars 10 years before his election.
I saw that book, actually. I did see that book. I don't agree with everything Al Gore says, though, about... He talks about population problems and things like that, which I don't quite agree with. But he did actually, he said a couple of things about the environment very interesting. So in summary, the very simple reason why there is a desire to maintain this very specific configuration of energy is because an alternative system entails the complete reorganisation of the way things operate here. It would mean a different form of society. It would mean a way of organising which is more decentralised. Energy would be more decentralised. Power structures would not be so centralised. Because at the moment, look at the way the power centre is organised. There is literally a military-industrial complex, and it has a physical geography to it. It has a centre in certain parts of the world. You have military bases centralised in areas of oil and gas, where there's huge areas of oil and gas. So there is a physical geography to this, and that centralisation will not be needed. It will just make it completely irrelevant. And that's really what it. That's really one of the huge fears. And that's why, in fact, there is a tendency, some scientists have complained of a tendency to actually suppress alternative energy research because it's just considered to be too subversive to the current state of affairs. So that's my take. My take ultimately is that we're living in the end point of an imperial system that has undergone various shifts over various times. The Second World War was one shift in that, and it wasn't the beginning of the imperial system. It was a certain shift, and we're now reaching another shift. And really, our position now is, where is that shift going to go? Because this particular global imperial system, as it is structured, is dead. It's utterly dead. It's hollowed out. It's just going to take perhaps 20 to 30 years, 50 years maximum, absolute maximum, on a kind of looking at conservatively. I'm a cynic. I think it's going to take 10 to 15 years. We're looking at about half a century maximum before the system utterly, utterly dies. The question is, what is going to take its place? You know, there are disastrous scenarios about nuclear warfare, about mad climate change, about all these kind of things, energy collapse, and all the things you've heard about, and also doomsday scenarios saying that we're never going to be able to do anything about it. But we do have a choice. We have the option now to basically articulate and move forward, call for a new way of organising our societies, a way that is based on different values, a way that is based on justice, based on love, based on compassion, you know, based on a different way of viewing the objectives of human life, and which will organise our societies, our economies, our polities on a much more decentralised and democratic basis. That's what we need to call for. Now, I don't know what that future looks like. I don't have a, you know, a communist manifesto, and I don't think anybody does, but we don't need one. What we need is the vision, because the human spirit has always gone through these tumultuous phases of history, and there's no time for the doom and gloom and for the kind of the idea that, oh, we're all gonna just go to pot. Because if we take that perspective, we've already doomed ourselves. We've made the decision, and the decision we have to make is to live. So my take is, really, we've got an amazing opportunity at this time of crisis to actually move to something drastically better, and that's it.
Now, I wanted to ask you, I mean, about ways of getting to this place. So I wanted to ask you, what is your take on kind of like the status of 9/11 in history? Because, I mean, I'm quite new to this, but I've discovered that, or I understand that the 9/11 truth movement is saying that 9/11 is really the key issue. It's undermining that system that you were just talking about. Whereas I'm coming from the background of a left-wing background, where people, in as much as they discuss it at all, they say, well, even if it was true, it's just another false flag operation in long lines, false flag operation, such a bad line.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's not really that significant. And I just wonder what you thought about that.
Well, I don't... I mean, I can understand where the 9/11 truth movement is coming from, in the sense that they feel that they're right, in the sense that 9/11 clearly was a turning point in the way in which international relations is being structured. You know, there were shifts from the Cold War to the post-Cold War, and then 9/11. And 9/11 was basically the premise on which everything is being justified. So the theory is that if you show that 9/11 was not what it was, the way it's made out to be, or that 9/11 was basically... our reading of 9/11 is drastically wrong, or it shows that there's a range of interpretations. There's a maximalist position, which is there was absolute complicity, and the whole thing was organised by the Bush administration or elements of the state, blah blah. Then and then there is a range below that. And whatever you take, whatever position you take, I think there is a consensus position, which is that Lan, which is a story, is basically riddled with inconsistencies and just completely untrue. The question is, what does that mean? And I don't really feel that it's productive to just say it's all about 9/11 and that's it, because what I find is the 9/11 truth movement then fails to kind of recognise that 9/11 didn't happen in a vacuum. 9/11 was the result of a system. It wasn't just the result of Bush and Bush sitting there saying, I'm going to push a button, you know, if you do hold to that view. 9/11 was the result of the, and the fact, even the rise of the Bush administration can be understood as the result of a dynamic process, the increasing criminalization of the US state apparatus over time. And I think to some extent the Bush administration can be understood in that way. So to me, it's like you have to understand 9/11 in its context, in its historical, economic, and political context. And that doesn't mean that you ignore 9/11, because on the other hand, there's an extreme on the left, which is like, 9/11 is not an issue. We don't want to know about 9/11. If you talk about 9/11, it's pointless. Interrogating 9/11 means that you're a mad conspiracy theorist, and just forget it. And let's talk about Iraq. Basically, that's the kind of left position, kind of traditional left position, which I also find very, very dissatisfying. And my feeling is that you need to interrogate all of these things together and see them as a whole and understand them as a whole. So it's not as simple as just saying it's less 9/11 is the key issue. Everyone can cling on to an issue and say the environment is the key issue, or this is the key issue. These are all key issues, but we need to basically, it depends who you're talking to. Sometimes your audience will be more used that they want to hear about Iraq, you know, and sometimes your audience will want to hear about 9/11. It depends who you're talking. You need to see where people are coming from. And that's really the way I see it. But I think ultimately we need to be able to make people have a global understanding of things.
Can I just say, just following on from what you were saying there about 9/11, it's not the only huge crime in the world ever, but because it has got the world's attention and has had the world's its power as a key for many people around the world having a better understanding of how the system and how the world really works, how the media really works, how the secret intelligence services really work, how the economy really works, all these things, you know, the kind of the subterfuge that states operate in, it's a really useful tool for introducing the way the world really works to people. So,
no, absolutely, I agree with that.
At the moment now, it's primarily that. It's not because it's the worst crime ever.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't. I mean, I don't think anyone's suggesting it's the worst crime ever. I don't think anyone's suggesting
that. And that's why I think it's really worthy of examination. It is a very powerful tool for us.
Yeah. Well, that's why I wrote two books about it.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, because, I mean, it is. Well, it's important to. Yeah. No, no, obviously.
I understand why the truth movement is so passionate, because why it's not the be-all and end-all. It certainly is a very, very important.
Well, I mean, I'm really disappointed with the 9/11 Truth Movement. You know, I think the 9/11 Truth Movement has shot itself in the foot so many times because, well, basically, they only see 9/11 and they don't do what you're doing, what you've said. They don't relate it to everything.
I agree.
You know, I mean, I just. Because it's just about the whole purpose of. I mean, a lot of the. I don't know, look. The US 9/11 Truth Movement is different to the British 9/11 Truth Movement. I've had a better experience in the United States. My experience in the UK has not been wonderful. It's been really a case of people obsessed with shouting that 9/11 is an inside job. And unless you shout that, and that's my experience, unless I shout that from the top of my voice, from the rooftops, then I am possibly a double agent. That's basically the feeling I get. From, you know, maybe I am, I haven't realised, you know, but I mean, obviously that doesn't represent everybody in the truth of it in the UK at all. But the sense I've got from a lot of people in the movement, and it's a very diverse movement, so it would also be wrong of me to characterise the whole movement in that way, because that's only, I would say, certain people that I've come across a lot. But that's the feeling I get, you know, and I think the movement needs to make an effort to grapple with multiple issues and bring them in, you know, to relate 9/11 to these issues. Because a lot of people just don't see the relevance. A lot of people kind of think, this is the perspective. You look at the, as you go to the anti-war protesters, they'll just be like, no, but it's not important. It's not important, you know. It's 3,000 Americans dead. What about the hundreds and thousands of Iraqis dead? And then they'll stop talking to you. So you have to find a way of...
But what he said, the whole world is focused on the 9/11 thing. It's surely the exposure of 9/11 would bring about enough of a shift in people's, the whole world's thinking, so that there may be a new philosophy in the world, whereas people stop taking media and authorities so seriously.
Why only 9/11?
Well, no, because it will be a sort of like... An opening, it starts. It's sort of like the one point that rips the fabric open. 9/11 got me studying history, which I never did before. I've studied so much.
It took your books.
But where does it go? If all you can do is say 9/11 is an inside job, where do you go from there? What does 9/11 mean?
If it is exposed.
Why did 9/11 happen? What does it mean? Do you know what I mean? What I'm saying is, it's not just about the World Trade Center was demolished by explosives. I have proven it. You know what I mean? It's like...
It's one simple thing that's going
where do you
to
go
spread,
from there?
Spread like a virus throughout the world.
No, it's not.
And
it's not.
People
they made it like that. They blew it out of...
What happened with JFK?
That's the whole idea.
If you take JFK, right? People thought that exposing JFK would be the ultimate solution to... I don't know, active from such a world consciousness. It didn't happen. There needs to be an integrated life. You know, human life is an integrated thing, and we need to approach it in an integrated way, because 9/11 didn't happen just because it didn't happen out of the blue. It happened as a result of the way the system operates. And 9/11 was also one particularly bad example, the worst example of a phenomenon that is actually very common to the way US power has operated. Not just US power, Western European colonial imperial power.
Human nature.
We need to inform people about
we as having humanity as having a slave nature in needing to a hierarchy and authority to bow down to and to accept mindlessly things that people on television tell us and governments.
Anyway, I think we better move. He's going to tell me to stop.
Yes, I would like to, if you can take two more questions.
Yes, yeah, okay. This guy's had his hand up for ages, so sorry. Go on. No. He's had it up for ages, and I haven't remembered to ask him.
Shane Collins from Land of the Green Party. Been fascinated by what you've been saying. I think for me, probably the most interesting thing is suggestions that the CIA and various other groups have kept on a relationship with Al Qaeda or all the governments of the Mujahideen to continue on in Central Asia. That's been fascinating. The nub of it, oil crisis and environment crisis. We've been in the Green Party, we've also been looking at this for some time. So it's really a question of what do you feel about using climate, using carbon quotas as a way of dealing with the recession that will follow peak oil and the possibility of further exacerbating the climate?
Well, it's going to get pretty bad if we carry on as we're carrying on now without any kind of attempt to reconfigure our societies. We won't have much choice. Do you know what I mean? It's going to be a case of there's not going to be enough energy to go around, and that's the situation we're looking at. And we may not feel it immediately, but we will start to feel it very quickly. And when we do, it's going to be terrible. And I think partly that is why we have this sudden rush since 9/11 of emergency legislation, some of which isn't even directly connected to terrorism. Here we've got the Civil Contingencies Bill, which gives huge draconian powers to the government to do what it wants to anybody, basically in a civil emergency. And President Bush just signed, when he signed the Military Commissions Act, he also signed the Public Disorder Act, that's what it was called.
They're building concentration camps.
Yeah, that's going on as well.
With asphyxiation gas.
Yeah.
They're actually using asphyxiation. This is true.
So the government, rather than thinking about the kind of things that the Green Party is thinking about, and thinking about, okay, what do we do? Policy, what do we do as a society in that kind of, in a situation? And we have to think as well, we have to think beyond just quotas. I mean, quotas is, like you said, an emergency kind of, it's an emergency thing that would need to be done to stop a kind of mad rush of chaos. But we need to think long term as well. How are we going to live? So in that context, the question of what the government is doing, putting through these kind of legislations, is they're not interested in even looking at these things. They're interested in, they're looking at a situation of social crisis, and they're thinking, how are they going to control that? There's no desire whatsoever to think seriously about reducing CO2 emissions. There's just no serious desire. If you look at the climate change minister that we've appointed, he's got no money. His office is just, it's just there for it, because the government knows that the public is thinking about these issues and they want to show they're doing something. So I think this is important issues, and we really need to have a public debate. We need to somehow bring these issues into a public debate and raise awareness of these issues. Yeah, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. Maybe a final question, maybe a quick conclusion. At the last section of your speech, you mentioned about if the human beings were to survive on this planet, certain values have to be changed. What I'm wondering, where do you think these values will come from?
Well, as a Muslim, you know, I believe in God, and I believe that there should be, that, you know, the need to have humanistic values. And as a Muslim, I take my values from my religion. Also, as a Muslim, I believe that you can't go around forcing your values on anybody else. My view is that human beings have to recognise that this particular industrial mechanic reductionist value system associated with capitalism is fundamentally dysfunctional. It's just not a very functional way of living. And we need a different value system. And I don't know how that's going to develop. I mean, I think people will do what they want. They will communicate with each other, and we'll talk about it, and we'll have dialogue, and we'll say, what should we do? How should we organise ourselves? And that's the way it has to develop. It has to be something fluid, because ultimately, especially in Islam, there's no compulsion to religion. If there is faith, faith has to come from within. Has to come from, otherwise it doesn't mean anything. There's no moral thing. So ultimately, it's a question of where, you know, humans have to make their own choice what we do. But ultimately, the choice has to be, if you're going to get anywhere, it has to be something which takes compassion as a bedrock. And I don't see how that's going to happen unless you somehow ground those values in reality. You don't see them as some disembodied thing that you just, okay, if you want to do it, it's good, but you have to have, in some way, you have to view the world in a way which integrates those values. So, I mean, my feeling is that there needs to be a move towards a more spiritual way of looking at things, you know, but people might disagree with me, but I think that's the way it has to go.
You've been listening to Nafees Ahmed, author and scholar from Brighton University in the UK, speaking last November in London. Thanks to Michael Riley and the London Sound Posse for that recording. This week, after a long hiatus, I'm going to finish Chapter 8 of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. This work, the result of a decade of research by this former award-winning teacher from New York City, seeks to explain that the school system that most people think is in place to create mentally equipped citizens for a democracy is actually doing just the opposite, and furthermore, was intended to create an obedient rather than engaged populace. The chapter we've been reading from tells how rising industrialists in the 19th century supported compulsory schooling as part of a larger plan to implement their vision of a centralized urban industrial economy, what Gatto calls a mass society. It was the discovery of coal, then oil, that both drove and financed this change. In the section I read previously, Gatto wrote, "Older American forms of schooling would never have been equal to the responsibility coal, steam, steel, and machinery laid upon them. America had to be massified and quickly. Since the end of the 19th century, American government and big business had been fully committed, without public fanfare, to creating and maintaining a mass society. Mass society demands tight administration, close management to an extreme degree. Humanity becomes undependable, dangerous, childlike, and suicidal under such discipline. Holding this contradiction stable requires managers of systematic schooling to withdraw trust, to regard their clientele as hospital managers might think of potentially homicidal patients. Students, men under military discipline, and employees in post offices, hospitals, and other large systems are forced into a condition of less than complete sanity. They are dangerous, as history has shown again and again. There are three indisputable triumphs of mass society we need to acknowledge to understand its strength. First, mass production offers relative physical comfort to almost all. Even the poor have food, shelter, television as a storyteller to raise the illusion of community. Second, as a byproduct of intense personal surveillance in mass society, to provide a steady stream of data to the producing and regulating classes, a large measure of personal security is available. Third, mass society offers a predictable world, one with few surprises. Anxieties of uncertainty are replaced in mass society with a rise in ennui and indifference. Now for the conclusion of Chapter 8, A Coal-Fired Dream World. Back at the beginning of the 19th century, wise men and women, honorable individuals themselves, came with sadness to realize that for all the foreseeable future, more and more ordinary people would need to give their entire lives to a dark hole in the ground or in service to a mind-destroying machine if a coal-fired dream world was to happen. People who grew up in the clean air and the folk society of villages did not make good workers for the screaming factories or the tunnels underground or the anthill offices. What was needed was some kind of halfway house that would train individuals for the halfway lives ordinary people would be more and more called upon to lead. In a utopia of machinery and steam, there could be free lunch for unprecedented numbers, but only if there were chains, bread, and water for the rest, at least for some unknown while. Plans for such a halfway institution as forced schooling, think of it as a training factory or a training mine, came together in Boston, Philadelphia, and New York, drawn by the best minds for the best motives. They inflicted stupendous damage on the libertarian rights and privileges bequeathed to Americans by the nation's founders. Profits from the industrial engine signed the checks for many 19th century educational experiments like New Lanark School in Scotland and New Harmony in Indiana. They bought Fanny Wright her school advocacy platform and helped her to impose it on the Philadelphia Working Man's Party agenda in 1829. Many of the 19th century experimental social colonies looked upon themselves as early emanations of utopia, previews whispering to men and women of what might be, if only they turned their backs on the past and schooled for a new day. The brevity of these experiments did nothing to discourage their successors. The coal of Westphalia, in association with the iron of Lorraine, welded the scattered states of Germany into a ferocious utopian empire in the last half of the 19th century. That empire, birthplace of successful mass forced schooling, made war upon the world, spreading its conception of research universities and its Spartan state philosophy of universal indoctrination and subordination all over the planet. In 1868, Japan adopted large parts of the Prussian constitution together with the Prussian style of schooling. The garment that coal fashioned for Aryan children was worn enthusiastically by coal-free Nipponese as their own. German mental science came to rule the classrooms of the world in the early 20th century, nowhere more thoroughly than in coal-rich and oil-rich America. America provided a perch from which to study people closely and resources with which to find ways to bring them into compliance. even without the intense ideological motivation driving the project. The prospect of a reliable domestic market which could be milked in perpetuity would have been incentive enough to propel the school project, I believe. These new studies, growing out of the coal-swollen ranks of leisured academic lives, suggested there should be radical changes in the mental diet of children. A plan emerged piecemeal in these years to be slowly inserted into national schooling. Seen from a distance a century later, it is possible to discern the still shimmering outline of a powerful strategy drawing together at least 10 elements. The removal of the active literacies of writing and speaking, which enable individuals to link up with and to persuade others. Destruction of the narrative of American history connecting the arguments of the Founding Fathers to historical events, defining what makes Americans different from others besides wealth. Substitution of an historical social studies catalog of facts in place of historical narrative. Radical dilution of the academic content of formal curriculum, which familiarize students with serious literature, philosophy, theology, etc. This has the effect of curtailing any serious inquiries into economics, politics, or religion. Replacement of academics with a balanced diet concept of humanities, quote-unquote, physical education, counseling, etc., as substance of the school day. Obfuscation or outright denial of the simple code-cracking drills which allow fluency in reading to anyone. The confinement of tractable and intractable students together in small rooms. In effect, this is a leveling exercise with predictable and pernicious results. A deliberate contradiction of common sense principles, rhetorically justified on the grounds of psychological and social necessities. The enlargement of the school day and year to blot up outside opportunities to acquire useful knowledge leading to independent livelihoods. The insertion of misleading surrogates for this knowledge in the form of shop classes, which actually teach little of skilled crafts. The shifting of oversight from those who have the greatest personal stake in student development, parents, community leaders, and the students themselves, to a ladder of strangers progressively more remote from local reality. All school transactions to be ultimately monitored by an absolute abstraction, the standardized test, correlating with nothing real and very easily rigged to produce whatever results are called for. Relentless, low-level hostility toward religious interpretations of meaning. There you have the brilliant formula used to create a coal-fired mass mind. Before his sudden death, I watched my beloved bachelor friend and longtime fellow schoolteacher Martin Wallach slowly surrender to forces of massification he'd long resisted. One day in his late 50s, he said, "There isn't any reason to go out anymore. They send food in. I have 300 channels. Everything is on TV. I couldn't see it all if I had two lifetimes. With my telephone and modem, I can get anything, even girls. There's only trouble outside anyway." He fell dead a year later, taking out his garbage. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. For more on Gatto's work, and you can download this entire book free online, by the way, at johntaylorgatto.com. And you can download this program as an MP3 free, also, by the way, at unwelcomeguest.org in the show archive. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Just like Bible, at the prophet's